Welcome, dear listener, to Volume 6 and Episode 4 of Weekend at Crombie's. And tonight, we will be watching Virtuosity. Welcome, dear listener. It's Weekend at Crombie's. My name is Dr. James Evans, Esquire. Hey, buddy, how's the wife and kid? Still dead, huh?
And I'm Hugh. I'm a 50 terabyte self-evolving neural network double backflip off the high platform. I'm not a swan dive.
Very good. I was going to use that quote as well, but I went with the family still dead. I was going to do that quote mainly because I guess in the mid-90s, 50 terabytes would have sounded incomprehensible. But nowadays...
mobile phones worth.
Yeah, well, I can buy 8 terabytes just in a high street shop. So, you know. But also, just before we start getting into this, that 1999 was a wild year, wasn't it? I mean, do you remember when we had sentient AI robots that were regenerating by eating glass? Do you remember that? Woo!
It is we should begin. It is the distant future, the year 1999.
I love films that set themselves too soon where they were made. I love it when they do that.
You see, this is where Gattaca has the edge, because Gattaca just comes up with something like in the not too distant future.
Yeah, exactly.
As in, like, it could happen.
Whenever you're watching.
Because Gattaca would never happen, but it would happen in a couple of years from now. You can just picture it.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas Virtuosity was made in 1995 and stupidly said, this is 1999. What are they thinking? Well, that's ahead of 4 years.
They should have not made movies, and, you know, put their investment in nanobites and glass.
They should have, shouldn't they?
But we'll begin. So we begin in the mean streets of 1999 Los Angeles. Parker Barnes is a cop in quite a fetching uniform. It's kind of like it's basically what futuristic cops wear. It's like a zip up body glove with a hat.
Or if I was in some kind of really, really heavy gay bar in Germany, I might wear that.
Yeah. Anyway, so Parker and his partner are going through the streets chasing someone they don't know who are, but Barnes kind of tracks him down into a sushi bar. Things are a bit strange in this world, apart from the fact that everyone is wearing grey suits and nothing else. It's a bit like that scene in The Matrix when they only see the woman in the red dress, and that will become pertinent because it turns out they are not in Los Angeles full of people with grey suits. They're in a virtual reality training mission. So these two people are real people who are plugged into this, pretend to be cops, and they've got to track down an AI-generated villain called Sid. Sadistic, intelligent, and devious.
Is that what it stands for? Of course it does. Yeah, really good. Yes. Yeah. It's never fully explained why they create him, really.
It's never explained why he gets to be called an acronym. And Sheila, another one, is just Sheila.
Well, maybe it means sexy.
Sexy, hot, electric, ingenious, lickable, and avataristic.
Yeah, there you go. It's not anyway. As catchy as Sid, but
yeah. Anyway, so they're tracking down Sid, played by a pre-fame Russell Crowe. So
looking very
young, very clean shaven, and we'll come into it, but having the time of his life.
200% Russell Crowe.
Oh yeah, so Sid 6.7 is in the and again we've initially seen, as apart from that everyone's wearing grey suits, as they go through
a bit,
it's that's quite well done. It's like the little glitches, like they're not like walking through this entire colourful grid where it's like Tron. It's like a real world with glitches in it, and even the sushi bars, all the NPCs are sitting having sushi, and the sushi disappears in their mouth, and like kind of
it's quite clever
that
you get sucked up almost, doesn't it?
Yeah, and they keep on eating their sushi. But they find Sid, who puts up a heck of a fight, because Sid does not go quietly, and in fact, Sid grabs Barnes' partner and kills him in the game, but then he holds someone hostage. Barnes decides just to shoot the hostage because he's not real, and then kills Sid, I think. Or they try and kill each other, but they're pulled out of the game.
Yeah, because they're having a kind of neural meltdown, aren't they?
Yes, because it turns out, you know, if you die in the game, you die in real life.
Yeah, partly because did they know this?
Well, you're not supposed to, but it's because Sid has, anyway, disabled the failsafes and cheated, because basically Sid has given himself extra power. So Sid 6.7 is a few upgrades too many, because he's already a bit too smart to be just a random villain to be caught. But
well, he's made of over 200 serial killers, isn't he?
Absolutely. Yes. So they pull Sid out. They pull Barnes out. Sid is still in the game. And Barnes' partner is going into like cardiac shock and he's brain dead. And at which point they realize, you know, something has gone very wrong. And we realize this entire thing was designed to train police officers in non-real environments. Mm. And because it was potentially dangerous, as shown by, in fact, one of the trainees is dead.
It's a pilot, isn't it?
Yeah, so they took on criminals to do it in, you know, for a lighter sentence or whatever. And Parker Barnes, played by Denzel Washington, if you're not mentioned.
Yeah. Firstly, Denzel Washington, previously in Malcolm X and Philadelphia, the three films, Malcolm X, Philadelphia, and this.
Is that it? No, yeah, it was like Malcolm X, Philadelphia, Cry Freedom. So. This, so are you saying that this, you know, this was beginning of Denzel Washington's shouting loudly with a handgun face?
Well, we'll come on to this in the analysis. Yeah. But I think Denzel Washington is in more of these kinds of films than we think he is.
Yes, very much so. And less of the Malcolm X ones than you think he is.
Yeah, exactly. And yet he still seems to maintain this aura of extreme acting, you know?
Yeah. But so Barnes was a police officer.
He was, wasn't he?
His family was killed by a political terrorist, Grimes, and he killed him back.
Everyone in this film has got names that you can shout really satisfying, like Grimes and Barnes. Yeah. Parker Barnes.
Yeah. Although we do realise that, yeah, Barnes killed Grimes. There's a whole backstory, but he also, in the process of killing all Grimes' gang, killed two news reporters who were interviewing Grimes at the time. Yeah. So that's what got him sent to prison. But anyway, as they're, you know, clearing up the mess and trying to reboot the programme because it's all gone a bit wrong, Barnes is sent back to prison, where it seems like an attempt is made on his life, because he's not sent back to the kind of the restricted zone where just police officers go. And he's sent back into Gen Pop, where a large...
Good use of the word Gen Pop.
There you go.
Have you been in jail before?
he walks in to face a large and very overtly Nazi criminal. I mean, this guy, they're really laying on the fact that he's very, very Nazi. He's like got the tattoos and he's Sigiling and all this kind of stuff. And he wants to, you know, kind of shank Barnes. Another word there, shank.
You have been in jail. This is a new side of you.
Barnes basically beats him down to show how tough Barnes is. And basically gives something interesting to do in the first bit of the movie, because that goes nowhere. I thought, someone on the jail is, you know, set to die. No, I think he's just there to beat up another prisoner to show he's tough.
My feeling was it was just to show us how incredible Denzel Washington looks with dreadlocks.
He does have dreads, doesn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I've never seen him with dreadlocks before. And it's also the counterpoint. Dreadlocks equals bad. Clean cut haircut equals good.
Oh, it's Highlander all over again.
He is, isn't he? Yeah.
But anyway, so... back to the computer lab, we should say that the programmer behind Sid is Lindenmeyer. He's a bit kind of enraptured by Sid, even though Lindenmeyer is the real person and Sid is the program. Sid is the you know, we said he's an amalgam of 200 serial killers. Really bad.
Yeah.
And they're having a bit of kind of like, it's almost like, you know, when Renfield was bewitched by Dracula, Lindenmeyer is in Sid's thrall. Yeah. So basically they want to get Sid out of the computer into the real world. And the way he does that is another employee of the company has also fallen in love with a sexy model. And I will say, for all the 1999 nanotech glitches, they're pretty spot on that the first use of any new technology would be used for sex and violence.
It's true, isn't it?
So this programmer has got Sheila 3.2 and basically wants to bring her into the world so we can have as much sex as possible with her. But Lindenmeyer switches over the chip. So instead of putting Sheila's module into the nanobot soup and creating a human being, Sid 6.7 is in the nanobot soup and comes to life. So
he is birthed out of a snake egg to house music.
Oh yes, he's kind of brain chip is this little crystal, which is our, you know, it's shown. But basically, he can also repair himself by eating glass.
Not even eating glass, just getting near it.
Yes, yeah, so whenever he's shot or chopped off or whatever, it's a bit like the Terminator 2, like this blobby bit appears on him, and then he just goes near any kind of glass to absorb it, and he can reconvene the silicone in the glass, puts it back. So now Sid is basically indestructible and on the loose. And so, predictably, he buggers off to Rampage. And Rampage he does. Rampage he does, but, you know, so now who can they bring in? Who's the guy that's tough enough to bring this man in? Why? If it isn't Parker Barnes.
Again, not any real explanation as to why, other than in the virtual reality world, he didn't get him.
Yeah.
But, well, yeah. But surely the whole LAPD can find Sid 6.7. Yeah. Sure.
Because I don't think they realize at this point, but amongst the 200 serial killers, and when we say serial killers, Saddam Hussein and Hitler in there too.
the definition of
serial killer is broad.
It's quite broad, isn't it? It's broad. We're talking about absolute bastards, aren't we?
That's that, yeah. He's absolute bastard to the power of 200, so you can be sure that anything that happens to Sid, he deserves.
But in all this, despite Saddam Hussein and Hitler being in it, the dominant personality is Grimes.
Yes. Because that's the thing. We find out later that Grimes is in the mix, but I don't think we find out at this point, because that would make sense. Saying who hunted Grimes down? It was Barnes. Then Barnes must be the guy to catch him. Either way, they think Barnes is their best bet.
I don't think it matters, does it?
It doesn't matter. But the person who vouches for Barnes is Dr. Madison Carter, who just has the largest shoulder pads going on.
Yes, I know. It's not even.
She's like a linebacker. But anyway, she is, as you'd imagine, she is the standard psychologist that hangs around police departments in the mid-90s, like, you know, offering advice and, you know, generally being frightened by things.
Well, she says, I want to go along with Parker Barnes. And, like, it was, well, why? Well, so that I can... She actually says, I might be useful helping him with some information.
Yeah.
That's not a reason.
but now that they're partners in hunting Sid down. Sid does firstly just general murders, and then he goes and gets a bit creative.
Well, he does general murders. He does the Manson murders, doesn't he?
Yeah,
kill all pigs.
Yeah, we can get into the tastefulness of the fact of using real murders.
Yeah.
Quite fresh in the mind. it's like, it's okay if you made him like, you know, Genghis Khan or something, but like, yeah. But Manson family's living memory. Anyway, so he did the Manson murders, but then he pops off to a nightclub and basically...
This is insane.
What things did he... Well, he kills a few people. He steals someone's suit, so he's all fancy dressed. And he gets people to scream in terror at different pitches that he can record it on his
scream orchestra.
Yeah, so we can record it on his like an electric organ, and then you can play a scream song, which I thought was quite cool.
Yeah, I did as well. He becomes a DJ in this kind of futuristic turntable setup, playing the sounds of people screaming.
Yeah,
and he's loving it.
Yeah, and so he's chased by Barnes. I mean, Barnes shoots him a few times. You know, he regenerates. I mean, they never learn that shooting Sid is not that helpful, because he just as soon as he gets near a window, he's okay again. But Barnes kind of goes. Barnes again. They work out. Barnes works out that Sid is kind of is upping the stakes every time. So having first just killed someone, he then goes to a nightclub, and then he goes to like this WrestleMania auditorium.
He's watching on the TVs in a TV store the fact that the nightclub massacre that he has done is big news, and he's thinking, hang on, this is a good idea, because obviously he's interactive, isn't he? So he loves the attention.
Absolutely.
And then obviously so that's where he says, right, I'm going to go to the WrestleMania kind of thing and cause mayhem.
Causes more mayhem. And again, it's funny. He starts creeping on, again, this attractive lady in the crowd, and then beats up her boyfriend. The reason he knows she's in the crowd, though, is the WrestleMania cameraman appears to have just pinned on one member of the crowd and no one else all the time, which, you know, I think maybe that cameraman should be implanted in Sid
as well.
A serial killer 201, because that's creepy. But anyway, he causes mayhem. Barnes shows up, shoots him a bit. Oh, there's a chase scene now. And the chase scene is, you know, Barnes does his usual, I've got a hostage in front of me, you know, and this is Sid. Sid does his, I've got a hostage in front of me, Barnes, you can't shoot me. Mm. Barnes nonetheless has a go at it, and the hostage is killed.
This is one of those weird bits in the film where Dr. Madison Carter has to tell the chief of police, Billy Cochran, no, Parker Barnes didn't shoot and kill the hostage. Is this the right bit?
It is, yeah. It's basically, yeah. But
why is she telling him that she was shot through the back, so it couldn't have been Parker Barnes.
Yeah, basically, Sid killed the hostage at the same time that Barnes fired and missed to look like Barnes had recklessly killed the hostage.
But surely, surely the chief of police would know this.
Yeah, a bullet hole in the back is different from a bullet hole in the front, and there's ballistics and everything. But that's not so Barnes is arrested, saying, you know, our agreement is invalidated. We didn't mention he's got like a bomb in his head as well.
He's got a bomb in his head.
A bomb in his head. It's the usual tactic: put a bomb in his head to keep him well behaved.
Yeah, because he's going to be allowed to be released if he catches Sid 6.7. If not, he's back in jail. And if he escapes, head explodes.
Except that live bomb in head. Yeah. But anyway, so Barnes is now going back to prison because of a apparently kill the hostage. At which point, Sid then raids the prison track and is all that kind of like Moriarty, you know, you are too good an opponent for me. I want you on the loose. So Sid kills the prison guards.
This is the thing, isn't it? This is where he lives for the opponent. It's not enough for him just to kill. He needs to have the attention, the adulation, the focus.
Yeah. So he frees Barnes, lets him run away. Yeah. But then we hadn't mentioned that that Dr. Carter. As she's, you know, getting to know Barnes, and then he goes to her house so she can pick up some data or whatever. He meets her young girl, played by a very very young Kelly Cuoco, as of The Big Bang Theory, but unrecognizable because she's basically dressed up like a hostage. She has an Alice band and a blonde bob haircut, and like I'm sure she's wearing a school uniform in the middle of the night. And basically, you know, she's all dimples and goofy teeth. It's like, hey mister, do you like baseball?
Have you ever shat someone?
Yeah, and she couldn't have plastered over, I'm going to be taken as a hostage some point in the movie. And sure enough, at some point in the movie, Sid takes this girl hostage. So now, like, you know, the hunt is really on. They've got to find her. So now Sid is...
Well, of course, in all of this as well, Parker Barnes is fighting for the memory of his wife and child. Yeah. And there's now an added frisson of nervous energy because this child has now been abducted again,
and perhaps
there'll be a similar type of event toward the end where we'll get retribution and catharsis from Denzel Washington.
Oh, very, very good. Yes, because he tried to rescue his wife and child, but it was like a bomb in the cells. You know, so he's howled. So Sid has now graduated to a television studio. I think he's basically saying, "Is it like if everyone phones in, I won't kill this person or something?" There's this whole
It's something like he raids what feel because there's news items about it or TV articles about this particular event that's happening throughout the film. It's going to be watched by 72 billion people on Earth. There aren't 72 billion people on Earth, but anyway,
well, not now in 1999. You never know what might happen.
Well, that's true, and it's something to do with Native American reparations or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is really weird. So anyway, he raids the studio, kills the Native American leader.
Yeah, immediately.
And then says, basically, I'm going to vote for who you want me to kill.
Yeah. So they work out that he's kind of his Achilles heel is attention. So they cut the phone line. So no one's dialing in anymore, which outrages Sid. Again, more cat and mouse continues. They have to go up to the roof, which is, I think it's in scaffolding. It's back to Die Hard territory. So they shoot each other a bit, and eventually Barnes basically kills enough bits of Sid that he can take away his brain module, and then Sid can dissolve into the nano soup. Except that, of course, they've done that, but he has hidden what's the name?
Kaylee Cuoco.
Little Kaylee Cuoco. Little Karen Carter. So Karen is still missing and, you know, and has been promised to die at midnight or whatever. So they've got to find that information. But Sid 6.7 is no more. How can they do this? So so Barnes goes into the virtual world to basically replay the scene.
Indeed.
Which he does.
Now, I'm not an idiot, but this particular sequence totally confused me.
I got it, but I didn't understand why they did it. So we'll come to the why they did it. But anyway, so he basically fights Sid again. It's the same setup. They're on the roof and they're fighting. And this time he managed to get the location of Karen out of Sid. And then basically says to Sid, you know, you're back in the cage. Because Sid believes he's in the real world. He can't distinguish the game and the real world. He goes, what, I'm in the game? He goes, yeah, you're in the game. Tough luck, Sid. Sid tries then to kill Barnes, and this whole, like, you know, his brain is spiking. We've got to free him. At which point,
Lindenmeyer, you know what, the weird thing is, though, In when Sid dies originally, and then they have to go back into the virtual world, it takes two or three goes before they get the information they need. And in one of those goes, Denzel Washington falls off the building and dies on the floor.
Yeah.
But he doesn't die in real life.
Well, no, it's because Sid had to do an electric zap or something to release the failsafe.
Is that why?
I think
it's the old electric zap.
I'm not going to defend it too much, but as they're trying to pull Denzel Washington out of the machine, that programmer, Lindemeyer, the guy who freed Sid in the first place, who's still hanging around, goes crazy and beats to death the chief of police. This was Billy Cochran, played by William Forsythe, who was kind of throughout the film, he'd been the guy like, you know, I'm trying to help you, Barnes, I'm on your side. And he's been kind of a good egg and really didn't deserve to get bludgeoned to death.
No,
like, I was expecting at the end just to find, you know, the chief of police with like an ice pack on the back of his head saying, oh, that was tough. But
he gets killed.
And it takes us
down to Madison. How is Lindemeyer not in jail already?
I know. At some point, it's down to Dr. Carter, who basically just pulls the plug on the thing and bounces out. So
he's out,
they made it out. So now they have to do. So now Sid has been dealt with, but they've got to go back to. They've worked out where the little girl is held. She's in the air duct, but there's bombs everywhere, and like, you know, there's infrared stuff and all this sort of stuff. So Barnes has to this time do it right. So he kind of has to sneak into the machine. There's a laptop that has Sid's grinning face on it, and an intense wire cutting scene. I don't know if we've mentioned, and this is where we have mentioned it. Barnes has a robot arm.
Oh yeah, he does, doesn't he? Yeah,
he's just got a robot arm.
Yeah. Which means it was blown off, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't mean terribly useful, apart from, you know, blocking the occasional thing. But he's got a robot arm. It's a really good one, Fina, 1999, you know, top quality. But he kind of uses a couple of wires from the arm to rewrap the thing, and it's like, and they think it's too late, but actually he's managed to send the bomb into a virtual loop, so it'll last forever. So all's well. Carter and her daughter are reunited. Sid has been defeated forever. And Barnes, kind of looking on the roof, has Sid's memory chip in his hand, which he flings off the roof and is quite lucky that a car then runs over it. Because otherwise, Sid's exponent could be out there in the world by someone who picks up the computer chip going, what's this?
It doesn't smash, does it? It
doesn't smash. It's just to be run over. I mean, but it's very dramatic. But that is the end of Virtuosity.
God, well done, Hugh.
I'd say
there's not a lot of plot in Virtuosity, but there's a lot going on, isn't there?
I think that sums it up. Yes.
Yeah, it's quite chaotic. Very good. Well, look, please, dear listener, take a little break. Get yourself.
Maybe game of chess with Sheila. The virtual reality chess.
A nice bowl of glass.
Ooh, tasty.
To chew down. Don't. I mean, if you are listening, don't do that. I don't want a lawsuit against me. Come back in a moment where we discuss why I chose Virtuosity and some of the themes behind it.
Very good. Welcome back, dear listener. I hope you are nicely filled on as much silicone as you can manage. and are ready to download at least 200 serial killers. But, James, so, I mean, do tell, why did we watch Virtuosity?
Well, I do love a serial killer film. And the 90s...
There's 200 of them.
I know. The 90s are a real hotbed of absolutely bonkers serial killer concept films, right? They are. It's full of them. So we will go on at some point to say, what films would you recommend alongside Virtuosity? But I'm going to bring that forward because this is one of the reasons why I chose Virtuosity. I can think of numerous films. They don't necessarily have to be serial killer films, or they don't necessarily have to be burgeoning CGI stroke virtual reality films. But they all have some things in common which link to a cop and a killer.
Oh, yes.
And the fact that a cop and a killer know each other or don't know each other or have known each other or will know each other, there's a high concept element to the film. And there's the thing about the 90s is that you could do all of these things and have money thrown at you to create huge or at least big budget films with absolutely no precedence or logic to them. So, you know, we've seen a few of them. Strange Days is one.
Yes, I thought Strange Days.
It could be like this. You've also got The Lawnmower Man, which is the same director, Brett Leonard, and Lawnmower Man 2. Yeah. But there's other ones like...
Yeah, go on. What immediately jumped to me when I was watching this is that this is Demolition Man.
And that's the other one I was going to say. It's Demolition Man, you know, cryogenically frozen. This killer comes back, and then another cryogenically frozen cop comes back because he's the only one that can kill him.
Exactly.
It's the same film. Yeah, it's the same film. But you've got other ones. There's Strictly... Ricochet is another one with actually Denzel Washington. Copycat is one. The 13th Floor, Split Second with Rutger Hauer. Fallen, another one with Denzel Washington. The Bone Collector, another one with Denzel Washington. Striking Distance with Bruce Willis. He plays a cop who can, he's the only cop who can catch this serial killer at sea, right? You know, it's so weird that in the 90s there were so many of these films, and Virtuosity was.
Is it because in the 90s we had no actual problems?
Come on, there were problems in the 90s.
The 90s was a golden age. The Cold War was over. The war on terror had begun. We had the burgeoning internet. And
I've got one word for you.
Go on then.
Wigfield. No, I do agree with you that the 90s were a time of optimism, and they were a time of abandon, I suppose, really, where the future, I think, in the 90s held opportunity and ambition for people, right? They did, didn't they? You know, we I think we assumed at the time that technology would enable us and free us to be able to do this kind of stuff as well. I disagree with you with the war on terror. I suppose it depends where you lived in the world, really, because there was a lot of stuff going down in the 90s. It just wasn't necessarily in America. But anyway...
No, I appreciate that, you know, if you happen to live in the former Yugoslavia, things were a little rougher in the 90s. Or possibly Rwanda. There are many places in the 90s.
Great.
There's many places in the 90s that didn't have a great time. But I think in Hollywood terms, there was no overwhelmingly oppressive thing to worry about.
Yeah. And so I suppose in that regard, these kind of absolutely insane high concept cop killer duos just felt, it was just like, yeah, let's have some fun. This is amazing.
If your biggest worry is the simulacrum of 200 serial killers will gain nanotechnology and start hunting people down, exactly. If that's the biggest problem you got, you're okay.
You're okay, aren't you? But that doesn't, I mean, so, and Virtuosity is in amongst those films, and it was one that I hadn't seen before, and I've seen almost all the others, because I really, really like these absolutely insane, stupid, high concept 90s films. Is there such a word as 90s-ness? Because this is that. These films are that. And I also looked at the trailer and thought, yeah, this is for me. We're watching this. Because it is absolutely barnstorming. The trailer is incredible. In some ways, the trailer is far better than the film, but it is blooming excellent. It's absolutely insane. So that's why I chose it. I thought, yes, it's right for a conversation. It's been a while since we've done this kind of weird high concept film, I guess, really, that isn't, because this doesn't have any pretensions to be high quality, I don't think.
High concept, but not high quality.
Yeah, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It might be a bad thing in the context of Virtuosity, but it isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Million, though. I mean, that's not nothing in the mid-90s.
No, it isn't. Well, it translates to about 60 million nowadays, which is certainly, I would call this a medium to large budget. Right.
Yeah. So they don't actually get made anymore. But
when that's the point. Yeah. Yeah. These kinds of films don't get made anymore because they don't make enough money, and they're not independent films. Studios don't make these films. They just don't make them. And that's why I think the 90s, in terms of this feeling of film, is so great, because there's so many of them. Those films that I've listed don't get made anymore. You've got the franchise films, or you've got the independent films. There's kind of nothing in between.
Yeah. I agree there.
So if the 80s were my burgeoning cinematic, where I started to really kind of get a feel for what I liked, the 90s were really where I immersed myself in cinema properly. And so films like this, and again, high concept, low quality, they will have a special place in my mind, you know, and it doesn't have to be Virtuosity. I mean, actually, The Lawnmower Man is a film that I've seen about 15 or 20 times. And it's not a great film, but I really like that film, partly because it was one of the first films I purchased on VHS myself, right?
Okay.
Out of my pocket money. And, you know, much like Virtuosity, the special effects in The Lawnmower Man have not aged well, but they're never going to. But the schlubby approach and the schlubby nature of these kind of films means that I kind of don't mind that the CGI looks a bit rough, really. You know, Russell Crowe's glass-baiting regeneration is not great special effects, but it kind of works in the context of a schlubby film about a nano serial killer, right? I mean, fair enough. So that's why I chose the film.
Very good. Okay.
And in terms of the themes of films, I think you rattle through the plot. And it, as I say, it doesn't have a lot of plot, but it has a lot of stuff going on in it. There is, I would just simply describe this film as chaotic. It's utterly, utterly chaos. It's a bit of a face melter in many ways. And by that, I mean, it's utterly insane. There's a lot of stuff in this film which is absolutely risible and terrible, right? I mean, really terrible stuff. The plot holes in the film are incredible. Just watching the film, and I'm usually a bit of a stickler for things like, well, I can buy into the logic of the world that they live in, but if something happens that defies logic in that world, I'm lost. If I went down that road of Virtuosity, I would have turned it off within about 5 minutes, I think. It's layer upon layer upon layer of this illogic chaos that happens. Some of it's terrible. Some of the acting in this film is some of the worst acting I think I can remember seeing in a major Hollywood film of any era. Kelly Lynch in this.
She's not good.
Is not good. Now, I don't think she is given a lot to work with. Right? Whew, she really isn't. But then neither is Denzel Washington. He does a pretty good job, right?
Yeah.
Kelly Lynch in this, I'm cringing. But even, you know, William Forsythe as Billy Cochran, the chief of police, he's got a moustache that is clearly just stuck on his face. It's so terrible. Now, this is nothing to do with the plot of the film. These are just fundamental things that I think in a $30 million film, just get a moustache that looks more real than the one that you're in, because he looks about 12 years old with this big bushy moustache, and he's terrible in this. He's absolutely terrible in it. There are huge leaps of faith that are made. So there's a decision at one point that Denzel Washington makes, and I don't really understand how he makes this leap. He's in the television shop interviewing people because Sid 6.7 has just killed one of the customers, and on the TV there is the WrestleMania thing. And he goes, and he runs off. And then, you know, obviously Madison Carter says, well, where are you going? And he says, exposure. It's exposure. And then he seems to know that Sid 6.7 is going to be at WrestleMania. But like, that's a big leap. That's a big jump, isn't it?
Oh, I mean,
it's a hell of a jump.
Parker Barnes' in detective skills are borderline psychic, because one of the reasons why he's able to solve the initial virtual reality puzzle in terms of how to find Sid and catch him is that because there's a smile emoji on the side of the building.
Yeah.
And he says, well, that clearly that's where it is. You put a smile emoji on the side.
It's like, exactly.
It's right. You've mentioned the actors, actually. You didn't mention, again, I think Russell Crowe is having the time of his life.
Oh, well, I'm going to go
saving
on to
him. Okay.
I'm saving him, and I'm kind of saving Denzel Washington a bit as well, because I think he puts in a really good shift in this as well.
But he
isn't given much in this. Russell Crowe is given everything in this, and he absolutely works it, right? So I think Russell Crowe has a section of all to himself.
Quite right, too.
in this.
Yeah.
Also the thing about Parker Barnes, you said, you know, his detecting is, you know, godlike. He also has a surprisingly large amount of knowledge about nanotechnology and virtual reality. I just have no idea why. He just seems to know everything about it. So all of these things are utterly odd. I've got no idea why the police don't seem to be able to catch Sid 6.7, or why even Parker Barnes is recruited to catch him. The scene when the commuter is shot, and, you know, Madison Carter has to tell the chief of police, yes, I've just looked at the bullet wound and it's come out of the front, which means that she was shot in the back. That's literally the kind of script work we're talking about here.
Yes.
That's said in the film, sincerely, right? And you think, blood, Jesus Christ, that is, you know, come on. But it's totally wild and it's out of control. And some films are out of control and their out of controlness and their chaos elevates them to mythic status in some respects. I don't think it's quite like that with Virtuosity because I think it's a bit too shabby. It's a bit too crap. Right?
Yeah.
Just a bit too crap. But there's elements of this which I found really fun.
Yeah.
As well.
I think, I enjoyed about it was mid-90s and they hadn't quite, you know, got hold of the Jurassic Park, the CGI yet. They were working what they had. Yeah. But I thought for a mid-90s thing, it didn't actually age too badly because they weren't that ambitious. It was
it's character driven, isn't it?
Yeah. More. I like the fact in the initial virtual reality, there's just a little flicker, like a glitch in the matrix, and you think, okay, that works for me. I'll understand where you are.
You don't need more than that, do you?
Yeah, and the outfit's slightly different and all that. And I thought, okay, well, that's good. You haven't tried to go over the top because basically, I think the worst example of it is in Disclosure when Demi Moore and Michael Douglas are dueling in virtual reality, trying to take a file out of a cabinet or something. And
it's really just, odd,
it's
isn't it?
So bad. It looked bad then and it looks worse now.
Dire Straits video from the 80s, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Money for Nothing or something. It's as bad as that, isn't it?
Yeah. So that wasn't as bad. And the fact that it's not as easy. That isn't bad. And again, funnily enough, I think we've got a better understanding of nanotech. I say understanding, I understand it at all. I understand the science fiction concept of nanotech more.
So
actually, you probably have a less head scratch to say, oh, yeah, he's made of nanos. They can do that.
So you just have to accept that, don't you, as a concept, right?
Yeah, and that wasn't too badly explained, too. They explained how it absorbs silicon and all this kind of stuff. So that was pretty good as well. What was I going to say? I think I've come into the talk about you say it was shabby. I think, and I'll make a quick comparison, I mentioned Demolition Man, because that's what really stuck with me, is that Demolition Man had its tongue firmly stuck in its cheek. And it wasn't just Wesley Snipes, who was the most outrageous character in it. Everyone was having a laugh.
Here,
Russell Crowe is having a kind of a Simon Phoenix set of laugh. He's larger than life. He's absolutely crazy. But Denzel Washington is playing it like he's the Equalizer.
Great.
He is very, very, playing it very, very straight. You know, the scenes when he's lost his family, I think, is very, very serious. And
there's a scene where he's in jail and he's drawing pictures of his family on the prison floor and he's crying. And you know what? Yeah. It's serious acting, isn't it?
Yeah. And that is the problem. There's two different films slammed against each other. One is ridiculous and one is quite straightforward.
One is utterly ridiculous.
Yeah.
And fun.
Absolutely. It's actually ridiculous in a good way. Sid 6.7, you know, go crazy in the real world because it's fantastic. He is a computer simulation who doesn't distinguish between reality and computer simulations. So he can do exactly what he wants. As a side note, the serial killer thing was a ridiculous idea. The fact that you have to make 200 really bad people so we know Sid's a really bad man. Was a really bad man from the first time there. Russell Crowe started gurning and machine gunning innocents. You don't need 200 guys in that. And in fact, all they need to say was, we gave him Grimes' personality because it needed one. We've accidentally created your nemesis. If Grimes had done something particularly Grimes-like, and then they could do the whole thing saying, there's only one man who could bring him down, the same guy that brought Grimes down before, and that's Parker Barnes.
Yeah, exactly.
It was none of
whereas
that.
Whereas actually, the reason why Parker Barnes is recruited is because in the virtual reality world, he nearly catches Sid 6.7.
Yeah.
And that's not really enough, is it?
Frankly, you could put a call out here to any kid who likes playing, you know, first-person shooters.
I guess this is where my point comes in, which is in the entire film, there's no LAPD anywhere.
Yeah.
And so surely you'd have better chance of getting Sid just by implementing appropriately funded police structures rather than having an ex-cop come out of prison because he nearly got him in a virtual reality world. He's the only man who could catch Sid 6.7 because he didn't in virtual reality.
Although the other thing is, again, he's the only man who can bring him in, and he does it by basically being a very competent and effective police officer. He's not the Demolition Man. It's not like we're unleashing.
No, he's not a superhero.
That's the thing. We're in Demolition Man. It's like we know he's going to destroy a lot of stuff. But he can catch Wesley Snipes. Here's like, he will go through the procedures of detection and listening to the police scanner and all this kind of stuff and catch him in the correct manner. So with even being just a regular good cop on to catch him.
Yeah.
But the other thing, I think the whole fact, the reveal of Grimes seemed to be mistimed. And I do know that I think there was some issue with the final edit of the film where the edit was taken out of the director's hands because they feared it was going awry. So that might explain why that was slightly miscued.
Because it's thrown in too late, isn't it?
Well, it would certainly explain why the ending is such a catastrophe, because there is a brilliant ending to be done here. And that's one where Barnes and Sid have their fight on the rooftop, and you think Sid has won and he's thrown him off. And then Barnes goes, no, no, we're still in the game.
Yes.
And then you wind your mind back and think, oh, yeah, there was some point when they could have switched. And I now remember I saw a flicker just like before.
Exactly. And when did it happen?
Yeah, and they fooled me just as they fooled Sid, and that's brilliant. And that's how the movie ends, because he goes, Sid, you're back in the cage. I'm out of here. Goodbye.
Yeah,
and that's how the movie ends. Except that they don't. He fights in real life. He loses, and he goes, I need to plug in and get back in the game. So he plugs in, and it's so sequential and laid out. You've got to think the editing's messed up there somewhere.
Yeah, I think you're probably. Yeah, I think you're right there, aren't you? I think you're right there. I suppose this comes. This is where we talk about being high concept and low quality. So Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe are both in another film together. About 10 years later, they made American Gangster, the Ridley Scott film, which is very high quality, but I don't think is as fun as Virtuosity or as entertaining, which is an odd thing to say, which leads me on to, and I think this is the point at which we should start to talk about Russell Crowe a little bit, which is obviously, you know, the most valuable player in Virtuosity. And I think the reason why Virtuosity isn't a catastrophe and is worth watching, actually. And it's for early career Russell Crowe. Now, it must take some chops to be in a film with Denzel Washington with only really Romper Stomper, maybe one other American film under your belt, to absolutely knock it out the park with a performance which is, I think, so high risk.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's really high risk, but he absolutely nails it. He's playing an AI villain, created out of 200 serial killers, right? Almost. If it's not going to be a failure, he has to play it at 200%. And he does. And he plays it so well. It reminded me a little bit of Nicolas Cage in Vampire's Kiss, in that oddly over the top. Like, it's so over the top, it's got to be deliberate.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you're not wrong there. He does absolutely nail it. And it's an insane performance. And it's you're right. And if it drops an octave, it would just look embarrassed. So he never drops it.
It would feel embarrassing. There's some scenes in the film where Russell Crowe quite literally cackles. You know, he cackles in the film. He does things like that. You know, he chops his finger off, licks the blue blood and goes, a good year. You know, it's stuff like that. It's insane. It's the fact that suddenly he seems to be able to jump 100 feet up through ceilings and fly over. It's the fact that he creates a scream orchestra, and it isn't embarrassing. It's just an utterly brilliant view. And when he plays it on the futuristic turntables and he's randomly shooting people, he's having an absolute whale of a time. It's an incredible performance. And I don't mean this flippantly. And I think I'm being genuine here. I think that performance is awards worthy, because it's totally deliberate. It's consistent. And it elevates what I think would be an absolute catastrophe of a film otherwise. You know, he saves this film. I think the film could have... I mean, it washed its face. The film washed its face, right? You know, so it wasn't a complete failure, but it was critically panned. Yeah. But to be honest, I think this is an example of where critics might have been a bit snobby about it, because I would watch this film because of Russell Crowe again.
It's worth seeing. We've often said, just watch this film because you need to see this performance rather than you need to see this film. I mean, Vampire's Kiss as well.
Yeah.
It's that performance, and it's
incredible.
I think he's done comedy before, because Russell Crowe, he's got a fairly broad range. You know, think he's not just the gladiator guy. He does a lot of stuff. But I don't think he's ever been as quite off the wall as this.
No, he's in a film called The Man with the Iron Fists, which is a kind of like a satire stroke homage to kung fu films, where he plays he's a very over the top character, which he said he modeled on the old Dirty Bastard, which is a rap, hip hop well, a rapper. I mean, a hip hop person. This is so. I'm so not South Central LA, am I? Oh my god! Despite actually quite liking the ODB, but there we go. So he's got history in this kind of stuff, and I think more recently, Russell Crowe is in films that we might call schlocky. You know, he's in a film recently called The First Exorcist or something like that, which is a bit over the top, and he plays quite an over the top character in this. And I quite like the fact that he's not afraid to slum it for fun, right? For me, the odder thing is, why the hell is Denzel Washington in this? Because, as I said, you know, this film came off the back of Philadelphia, which came off the back of Malcolm X. So you got Malcolm X, Philadelphia, Virtuosity, and then I started to look into his oeuvre a bit, and it made me realise he's in a lot more of these films than I thought he was.
He's in loads, and I do remember
in the 90s particularly.
It might have been a throw of the 90s particularly, but I mean, it's a funny thing is, I think I remember might have been a throwaway comment. He made the comment, I think, after doing like Malcolm X, saying, "I don't want to be the guy they come to for the Nelson Mandela biopic." Because he was starting to get that feeling, like, he'd done Steve Biko, he'd done Malcolm X, and he's like, "Am I just going to do the like historical black guys, and that's it?" And then he just kind of like, pivoted into, I mean, it was after Crimson Tide, pivoted to Virtuosity, and that was Virtuosity was kind of his first cop one, wasn't it, where he basically because there's a moment when he's like in the prison yelling at the inmates, and I thought, I've seen this yelling before, this, or at least maybe this is the first time that the yelling happened, but Denzel Washington yelling into the sky, thinking, you know, all he needs is a handgun, and then he's there, and I thought,
then he's there,
he's done
he?
A yeah, lot exactly. of movies like this, and it's funny that you mentioned the mid-90s, because that's I mean, Denzel Washington is, you know, he's a staple of Hollywood. He's been in all of things.
Of course,
but the last film, like, I really remember, you know, him being in, were in the 90s, because that was when he did, again, non-standard films where he's just chasing people down. And now it's like, it's all he does. The Equalizer, Inside Man, John Q, Training Day. I mean,
it's American Gangster. Similar kind of films like that, aren't they?
Taking of Pelham. And it's like, there's this, like... It's
I know.
So strange that's his now his oeuvre, which you thought his oeuvre is much more Academy Award winning stuff, but it's not.
Is it? No. I mean, you're right. Yeah, John Q is a good example as well, isn't it? So, you know, mid to late 90s into the early 2000s. And really, he's a schlocky A-lister. He's slumming it in B-list films, isn't he?
That's the thing. They're never just... Yeah, they're never quite the level of Taken, but they're not far off it.
Like, no, I know what you mean. Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
he's always, you know, a guy with a handgun and a bit of a story behind him that he gets his teeth into.
Well,
but it is
to right.
involve him just, you know, shooting bad guys at the end.
I mean, yeah, I could read out a list, and this is insane. So, Virtuosity, obviously, Out of Time, The Siege, Ricochet, Fallen, John Q, Safe House, Two Guns.
I mean, Equalizer 1, 2, 3.
Yeah. The Taking of Helen 1, 2, 3. The Bone Collector. Unstoppable. Deja Vu. You're right. Man on Fire.
And it wasn't until something like Fences that you think.
Yeah, Fences, yeah, you're
Fences
right. Which
comes
great.
In and you think Fences, oh, that, you think Fences, that's a Denzel Washington movie. But clearly it's not.
you should be watching Taken and thinking, why isn't Denzel Washington in this? This should be great for Denzel Washington. It's really weird, isn't it? Two-time Academy Award winner. Now, you know, Oscars don't necessarily mean they're paragons of quality necessarily, but nevertheless, two-time Oscar winner Denzel Washington is in a lot of trash.
It's not like Orson Welles doing the Sherry commercials. Of consistently output kind of B movies that wash their face and pay for the next one and will get an audience. And it's just a steady grind of these films for the last 30 years.
It's weird, isn't it? Because it's not even like he's in these films to finance the other films that are more serious that don't make any money, are they?
Yeah, it's not like one blockbuster, then one art house, one blockbuster.
No, he's just in these, and these aren't even blockbusters either, are they?
No, no.
They're middle. I mean, we said that they don't make middle brow films anymore or mid budget films anymore. Yeah. But maybe the only person that is making them is Denzel Washington. He's the only one making them, isn't he?
There you go. He's cornered it.
Yeah, I mean, I would possibly exclude Training Day from that list because I think that is a cut above.
Well, that's where he won the Oscar for, wasn't it?
Yeah, he won. Yeah, but it is of the same ilk.
Yeah, I did. I saw Inside Man quite recently. It was Spike Lee directed that, wasn't it?
Yeah, Spike Lee. Yeah,
and
it's
because it kind of explained why Denzel Washington was kind of wearing a broad brimmed hat and quite a fancy suit as a but it was like Spike Lee's attempt to do a Denzel Washington movie, if you like, rather than the other way around, because Spike Lee wouldn't normally make that kind of movie either.
No, he wouldn't. You're right, actually. And the other type of we've talked about things like Man on Fire and The Equalizer and The Bone Collector and Ricochet and all those. The other type of film that I think Denzel Washington is in quite a lot that we don't think he's in is the almost like the person that has to teach groups of people about life and their place in the world. So he's in Remember the Titans. Is one. He's also in He Got Game is another example of that, I think. What's the one? Antoine Fisher, he's in The Preacher's Wife, Great Debaters, you know? I'm starting to think that Virtuosity is Denzel Washington's level, actually.
We all started. But again, you take all the posters of the films we've just mentioned, the kind of the deja vu, the Man on Files and stuff, you remove the titles from those posters, and it's basically Denzel Washington in a fairly good close-up, with or without an antagonist, something will be on fire, and he'll look being very grim. And something will be on fire. And God help you if you can pick which movie is which if the titles aren't there, because it could be any of them. It could be all of them.
Possibly do that, yeah.
Maybe they just call up the guy saying, we need one of them Denzel Washington posters. It's just like, don't worry, I got you. Just move it around a little bit, got you then. It's crazy.
It is crazy, isn't it? Yeah, it's so bizarre. I mean, actually, the other reason why I wanted to choose Virtuosity as well, because in looking at Virtuosity, there were quite a few of these films. A lot of these films could be Weekend at Crombie's films, couldn't they? Really?
Oh, indeed. Yeah.
You know, a lot of them could be. And even some of his earlier stuff, like he's in a film with Bob Hoskins, where Bob Hoskins plays a racist man who has a heart attack and has a heart transplant. And the heart that's transplanted into him is Denzel Washington's, who then haunts him. And that, I mean, that is, you know, that it's, what decade do you think that's from?
That's got to be the 80s.
Yeah, that's from the 80s. Of course it's from the 80s. And he's in another film. He's in another film with George Segal in the 80s, right? Where the synopsis for this film, a middle-aged, married, wealthy, white corporate executive, George Segal, is surprised to discover that he has a working-class black teenage son who wants to be adopted into the almost exclusively white upper-middle-class community of San Marino, California. That's another 80s film right there. Isn't it? I mean, for goodness sake. So it makes me wonder, what the hell? How has Denzel Washington got the reputation that he has? How has he? For me, it must be Philadelphia, Training Day, and Malcolm X.
It was Glory that started it all, of course.
I suppose, yes.
Glory got him the Academy Award. And then, from that, Malcolm X, Philadelphia. Again, Crimson Tide was on the cusp, wasn't it? It wasn't quite a cop movie.
But it's the same film, though, isn't it? It's the same film. I mean, I've never even heard of Two Guns.
No.
What's Two Guns? What? So, so here's us saying, Russell Crowe is so over the top in this. But you know what? I mean, Denzel Washington is playing this. He's playing this all wrong. He's playing it straight up. I was laughing my head off at the scene where a tear just comes out of his eyes. Well, where else is a tear going to come out of, I suppose? A tear drips out of his eyes as he's drawing pictures of his family on the prison floor as he remembers them. And I'm thinking, you're in the wrong film, Denzel. What you're doing isn't this film, right? I want to see, where's Sid 6.7 again?
Yeah.
Get him back on.
Dear me.
Anything else?
We have to Courage Under Fire was that the other one, wasn't he?
Courage Under Fire, yes! It's the same film!
Oh, dear me.
They've even got the same kinds of titles, haven't they? I mean, they're not the same. I mean, Courage Under Fire is a different title to Deja Vu, which is a different title to The Bone Collector or Man on Fire. But they're all the same.
It's just playing Mad Libs with Denzel Washington film titles.
Yeah. Do you want to watch Safe?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to watch Safe House, John Q, Man on Fire, Two Guns, Crimson Tide, or Deja Vu tonight? And you go, I don't care. Aren't they all the same film?
I think actually, yeah, if you, a good parlor game would be all the synopses of Denzel Washington films with all the titles. You have to somehow match them up with all the film titles, with all the movie posters. Movie poster, synopsis, and title, all in a big mix in the middle. Can you piece them together?
It's the new Bob Hoskins, isn't it?
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
But I think we've gone through the film, eviscerated poor Denzel Washington's career. I'm sure he'll survive.
Oh, yeah. Who are we to do that? I mean, my final point on the film, I think, is it's one of those rare beasts that you get so infrequently now. A mid-budget film that was made a lot in the 90s. And I think this is a film that's par for the course in the 90s. It's no better or worse than any of the other types of films that were doing exactly the same thing, i.e. utter chaos on screen and having money thrown at it.
Yeah.
The difference is that this has a Russell Crowe who is incredible.
Yeah, I think I will say again in my summary of it, yeah, I didn't enjoy how the fact was the thing was so full of plot holes, but probably more than that, the fact it wasn't silly enough. It was only half silly, and that almost like we said that, you know, if Russell Crowe had pulled back, it would have been embarrassing. Almost the film has pulled back, and that makes the film a bit embarrassing, because if it had all been as loopy as it had been with Sid, that'd have been okay. Or again, if it's like RoboCop kind of loopy, you know, they've created something they can't control.
Yeah, you're right, actually. And I tend to think there's two things that are very problematic that mean that the film isn't more remembered, really. The first one, I think the direction of it is very bland.
Yeah.
And you know, Brett Leonard, if you're listening, I'm sorry, but you know Martin Scorsese, are you? Really? And that's a problem. The second one is that the script doesn't give any other character other than Sid 6.7 anything to work with, and unfortunately there's some acting in it which really highlights how poor the script is. Now Denzel Washington might be in the wrong film, but at least he's okay in this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas some of the others are just kind of cringeworthily, they're just awful, and that brings it down as well.
Yeah, fair point.
Okay,
so
here we go.
Shall we move on to giving it its scores and finding out what we'll be watching next week, next month?
It could be next week, couldn't it?
Oh, it could be next week. Yes.
It's the scores on the doors. Yes, indeed.
Join us then.
Welcome back, dear listener. Yes, it's the scores on the doors, the moment you've all been waiting for. It's nearly the end of the show. I was going to call it a show. I'm channeling my Sid 6.7 there, aren't I?
It is No one dies, though.
No one dies. Through illicit means, anyway. I can't say for sure that neither you or I will have a heart attack in the next 5 minutes or so, but, you know, let's hope not. Anyway.
If I do have a heart attack, I hope Denzel Washington's heart is placed into mine.
Yeah, but the problem is, though, Hugh, you're not racist.
Oh, see, falling down again.
Yeah, exactly. You need to be a real racist bastard. Anyway, you go first. You tell us the scores on the doors.
Okay. Scores on the doors. Again, I don't think I got into it too much. This was a strain to watch, but it was. The plot was all over the place. again, you watch it, I think, for Russell Crowe's performance. There's nothing in here that's either clever enough or fun enough to really romp you along. And had it been just a bit, again, if it had embraced its silliness, I think that would have been better, because it has an idea behind it, and I'm probably most disappointed by the things that didn't happen in it that I think they wanted to do, but, you know, something got in the way of making it a really good, memorable movie. So for me, just two floating Crombie heads, I'm afraid.
Very good. I don't disagree with anything that you've said there. I think that I have a predilection towards these odd bod films to a certain extent. I'm probably more forgiving of them than I should be. But, you know, Russell Crowe obviously is the I almost said Russell Grant then. Who's Russell Grant? Anyway, no, I don't know. Imagine him in this. That'd be amazing. So Russell Crowe is obviously the most valuable player. But I guess for me, a bit like in Vampire's Kiss, the Nicolas Cage acting in that and the Russell Crowe acting in this are hewed from the same rock, aren't they? They're the same thing, and I really like that. This isn't as good a film in my mind, because I agree with it. It doesn't embrace its silliness enough. But if someone said to me, we're coming round. We've got a DVD of Virtuosity, and we're going to bring some popcorn. Would you want to watch it with us? I'll probably say yes, all right. So it's going to be three disappointed Crombie heads for me. Amazingly, the film is awful, but I would watch this again in a heartbeat. So three disembodied Crombie heads.
There we go. Three disembodied Crombie heads. So, and thus we can now pull the plug and disengage the C drive of Virtuosity as we find out what we'll be watching in the merry month of May.
Oh, dear, dear, dear. Yes, indeed. Tell us, Hugh. Tell us.
In May, we shall be watching Brewster's Millions.
Brewster's Millions. Brewster's Millions. Very good. Very good. I'll have to. I will have to find my old VHS copy of that.
And until then, we shall wish you both a both. I'm vastly overestimating our audience there. Maybe
surely we've got two now.
I don't know. We've got two. So I wish any and all of you a very happy and a very healthy weekend at Crombie's.
Good evening, all. Weekend at Crombie's. Right, Hugh. It is precisely 90 minutes past my bedtime.
Oh, okay. I'll let you get off.
Admittedly, this podcast starts after my bedtime. So,
are you serious?
Yeah, pretty much. Eight o'clock. Right. Let's say 8 o'clock is when I'm in bed most days. I mean, I have a wank, don't get me wrong. I'm usually asleep by 5 past.